All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, August 28th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. It's Friday, everybody. We made it again. The summer is winding down here in upstate New York. It is 59 degrees and partly sunny here. And it is definitely cooler than it should be. The dog days of summer were usually hot and humid, at least for the next few weeks. So kind of wish summer would come back just for a little bit. But it is almost over. School in New York kicks off early next week. So that means that many of us who've been cruise director for the summer actually gets our days back to do some other things. So where did we leave off over the last few days? Sorry I wasn't here yesterday. Definitely had some wind kicked out of me that I had to kind of regroup and get my thoughts back in order. But the day before yesterday, so that would have been on Wednesday, the title of the show was EPA, RNAi, and Government Human Experiments. We had taken a look that was actually part two of Tuesday's show that was titled BioDirect, Monsanto's new RNAi gene flipping spray, if you remember that. Yes, an easy way to get around GMOs is just to spray RNAi all over them to manipulate the traits of the produce, let's say, that then washes off in a few weeks, so you won't even know that it's there, but then they won't have to label it as such. And we took a look at the EPA's hearing that they had gotten together, a board of experts, to kind of give their impressions. And pretty much what it came out to was, now we're not too worried about what it's going to do to humans when they ingest it, but we are a little more concerned about what it's going to do to the environment. So keep an eye on that. It's called BioDirect. It's by Monsanto. It's a spray made of RNAi to spray on fruits and vegetables. And I don't know. I think it's kind of disturbing. But where I really wanted to take this today, maybe we'll get back into some of that stuff next week. This week has kind of been disjointed. And to be completely honest with you, my brain has just been completely, mud, I would have to say, this week. So I'm not really going to dig too much into that. But listen, I got a message yesterday from a gentleman that runs a website called Disinformation. I've been reading their stuff for quite a while. His name is Brian Whitney. Not sure if Brian has listened to Before the First Cup or not, but I'm going to see maybe if Brian would be interested in coming on and doing an interview with us one day. He dropped me a message on my Behind the Curtain page about a story that he had written titled Catching Up with the Unabomber, When Does the End Justify the Means? And, you know, we've been looking at this dystopian technology now for quite a long time. I mean, I was just kind of scrolling down through some of the titles in the playlist, and it's pretty crazy. The RNAi stuff, BioDirect. Scientific American says GMOs are all in your head. Remember that one? Project BioShields equals unapproved vaccines during emergency. DOD, CDC, and Big Pharma collusion. The Biotech Act of 2015. Mad Science Gone Mad, U.S. Israeli Foundation, and the bioeconomy, evolutionary robotics, focused destruction, and biodesign, the new RNA vaccinations, and the CRISPR gene drive. I mean, guys, this really is insanity. DNA switch flipping and immortality. Well, you know, back when we were doing these shows, within the same week, I had received two different messages from two people suggesting that I look into the Unabomber. And honestly, back when the whole Unabomber thing was going on back in the 90s, I believed him to be a lunatic that lived in the woods, just like the propaganda evening news wanted us to believe. But as I started reading a little bit more about the Unabomber, and we did a show on him back a few months ago, I started to realize that he is saying exactly what we are saying now, except this gentleman was saying this 20 plus years ago, and he wasn't a crazy man. He actually was a university professor at one of the California universities, UC Berkeley, back in the 60s. The guy was quite bright. And he was pushed to the point of desperation to get his point across. It says that back in 95, between 78 and 95, actually, he had sent 16 bombs to universities. And in this story here, there was an interview done with somebody who had started corresponding with the Unabomber. The reason he did that was to gain attention so people would read his manifesto. Because back in those days, 1995, the internet was just very fledgling. Windows 95, 20 years ago this year, Windows 95 was released, and that was really the very first, if you don't include Apple, which had a very small market at that time, but at least for the mainstream, this was the very first time that user interface was dumb and user-friendly enough that the general population would jump on board with their sub-$1,000 PCs, and technology went mainstream. So anyway, I have three things I'd like to read today to kind of look at not only the Unabomber, but we're going to get back to Why Technology Doesn't Need Us Anymore by Bill Joy, the former CEO of Sun Microsystems. Anyway, let's get to the story. So Brian Whitney is the author from disinfo.com. Title, Catching Up with the Unabomber, When Does Ends Justify the Means? The Unabomber, known as Ted Kaczynski, was not a fan of technology. And to expose the world to his anti-technology philosophies from the years of 1978 to 1995, Kaczynski sent 16 bombs to universities and airlines, killing 3 people and injuring 23 before he was eventually caught and sent to prison. And he remains there today. At one time, he was possibly the most famous criminal in the world. He said of technology's role, quote, "The system does not and cannot exist to satisfy human needs. Instead, it is human behavior that has to be modified to fit the system." And that's exactly what is happening today. The system has been built, and now our behavior is being modeled through disasters and climate change and, oh my God, the violence, the guns, oh, diseases. I mean, they are using, whether or not they're manufactured, they are using propaganda. They are propagandizing events to manipulate us and fit us into the mold of the system that they have created. Back to his quote, "It is the fault of technology because the system is guided not by ideology, but by technical necessity." In his essay, Industrial Society and Its Future, Kaczynski argued that whilst his bombings were, quote, "a bit extreme, they were quite necessary to attract attention to the loss of human freedom caused by modern technology." His book, Technological Slavery, The Collected Writings of Theodore J. Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, breaks all of his philosophies down for those of us that just know him through the corporate news stations, which I was one of them. I really thought he was just a crazy lone wolf bomber that lived in the woods. I had no idea about his manifesto. Back to the story. Was the Unabomber crazy or just so sane that he was blowing our minds? This author, Brian Whitney, spoke to a David Skirbina, a confidant of Kaczynski and a philosophy professor at the University of Michigan. Skirbina wrote the intro to Technological Slavery, which was Kaczynski's book. All right, so now it's going to be a Q&A. Can you tell me a bit about how you and Kaczynski began to communicate? Are you still in touch with him today? This is the doctor. Back in 2003, I began work on a new course at the University of Michigan called Philosophy of Technology. Surprisingly, such a course had never been offered before at any of our campuses, and I wanted to remedy that deficiency. I then began to pull together recent and relevant material for the course, focusing on critical approaches to technology, as these to me were more insightful and more interesting and were notably more underanalyzed among current philosophers of technology. While most of them are either neutral toward modern technology or positively embrace it, which is what I still see going on in the general populace, so that's my interjection, or its acceptance is presence resignedly. As I found out, very few philosophers of the past four decades adopted anything like a critical stance, and this, for me, was highly revealing. Anyway, I was well aware of Kaczynski's manifesto, Industrial Society and Its Future, which was published in late 1995 at the height of the Unabomber mania. I was very impressed with its analysis, even though most of the ideas were not new to me and many were just reiterations of arguments by Jacques Ellul, whose examples see his 1964 book called The Technological Society. But Kaczynski's manifesto was clear and concise and made a compelling argument. After Kaczynski was arrested in 96 and after a year-long trial process, he was stashed away in a supermax prison in Colorado. I just saw a story about that prison, how there's lots of human rights abuses, apparently, that have been called out in that prison. The media then decided, in essence, that the story was over. Case closed. No need to cover Kaczynski or his troubling ideas ever again. But by 2003, I suspected he was still actively researching and writing, but I had heard nothing of substance about him in years, so I decided to write to him personally, hoping to get some follow-up material that I might use in my new course. Fortunately, Kaczynski replied, and that began a long string of letters, all on the problem of technology, and to date, I have received something of over 100 letters from him. Most of the letters occurred in the few years prior to and just after the publication of Technological Slavery, and several of his more important and detailed replies to me were actually included in that book, about 100 pages worth. We have had less occasion to communicate in the past couple years, but my most recent letter from him was late in 2014. So again, question. You have said that his ideas, quote, threaten to undermine the power structure of our technological order. And since the system's defenders are unable to defeat the ideas, they choose to attack the man who wrote them, unquote. Can you expand on that? Why, yes, the military presence, and this is quite telling, and he's right on the money. The military presence and economic power of the U.S. government and governments everywhere rests on advanced technology. Governments, by their very nature, function to manipulate and coerce people, both their own citizens and any other non-citizens whom they declare to be of interest. Governments have a monopoly on force, and this force is manifest through technological structures and systems. And I don't know if anyone saw, but over the last 2 days, I actually did a story on Antimedia about it yesterday. North Dakota is the first state to legalize non-lethal weapons on drones for use of law enforcement. So put on a seatbelt, people, because I will guarantee you that it will not be too long before that is adopted elsewhere. And non-lethal weapons include rubber bullets, tear gas, pepper spray, sound cannons, tasers. Do you imagine being tasered from a drone? That's a pretty scary thought. And I mean, the march just keeps going forward. That's why I thought it was very important for us to listen to some ideas from some very smart people who have not only been in technology, but have also been looking at the philosophy and the ethics behind all of this. And I mean, this is what I stand for. I can't even get over how duped we have been in helping them usher in this entire new world of technological slavery. And I mean, honestly, I worked for many years. This is all I ate, slept, and breathed. I totally believed in it 100% and saw this utopia at the end of the rainbow, and it hasn't quite worked out that way. So anyway, back to the story. Governments have a monopoly on force, and this force is manifest through technological structures and systems. Therefore, all governments, and in fact anyone who would seek to exert power in the world, must embrace modern technology. American government at all levels is deeply pro-tech, and we've seen that over the last few weeks looking at that whole bioeconomy and the whole new supercomputing initiative and the whole brain project. I mean, this, even though it crosses over some of it into the realms of healthcare, the whole healthcare, biopharma, genomics, big ball of ugly earwax is all a part of technology now. We have been technologicized, if that's even a word, down to the cellular and the atomic level. And this is very, very, very frightening. The American government at all levels is deeply pro-tech, and so too are our corporations, our universities. Yes, universities have all been sucked into the vortex, and other organized institutions. Technology is literally their lifeblood, and they couldn't oppose it in any substantial way without committing virtual suicide. So when a Ted Kaczynski comes along and reminds everyone of the inherent and potentially catastrophic problems involved with modern technology, quote unquote, the system doesn't want you to hear it. It will do everything possible to distort or censor such a discussion. And as you may recall, during the final years of the Unabomber's episode, there was very little, astonishingly little, discussion of the actual ideas of his manifesto. Now and then, little passages would be quoted in the newspapers, but that was it. No follow-up, no discussion, and no analysis. Basically, the system's defenders had no counter-arguments. The data, empirical observation, and common sense were all on the side of Kaczynski, and there was no rational case to be made against him. The only options for the defenders was an ad hominem attack to portray Kaczynski as a sick murderer, a crazy loner, and so on. And that's exactly what I believed about Kaczynski. I had no idea about his manifesto. That was the only way to discredit Kaczynski's ideas. And of course, as we know, the ad hominem attacks are logical fallacies. Kaczynski's personal situation, his mental state, or even his extreme actions have precisely zero bearing on the strengths of his arguments. The system's biggest fear was, and still is, that people will believe that he was right. People might begin, in ways small or large, to withdraw from or to undermine the technological basis of society. This cuts to the heart of the system. It poses a fundamental threat to which the system has few options apart from their ongoing propaganda efforts and their brute force. And there you go. That is absolutely 100%. We need to wake up and realize that for all the promises of living forever and curing all your diseases, your dementias, your obesity, your diabetes, your cancers, because there are cures now coming for all that stuff using this newfangled genetics technology, that it is not in the best interest of the long-term survival of the human race. All right, back to the story. Question, what do you think of the fact when our government or any figure in authority, such as a police officer, kills in the name of the established belief system, it is thought to be just. But when a guy like Kaczynski kills in the name of his belief system, he is thought to be a deranged psychopath. Answer. As I mentioned, government authorities have a monopoly on force. Whenever they use it, it is almost by definition, quote unquote, right. Granted, police can be convicted of excessive force, but such cases, as we know, are very rare, and militaries can never be so convicted. At best, if the public is truly appalled by some lethal action of our police or military, they may vote in a more pacifist administration, but even that rarely works, and people were disgusted by the warmonger George Bush, so they voted in quote-unquote anti-war Obama. Ironically, he continued on with the same much killing. And through foreign aid and UN votes, Obama continues to support and defend murderous regimes around the world. So much for pacifism. But let's keep in mind, Kaczynski killed 3 people, and that was tragic and regrettable, but still, it was just 3 people. American police kill that many citizens every other day on an average, and I would say even more than that. And the same with Obama's drone operators. Technology kills many times that number every day and every hour. Let's keep things in perspective. Kaczynski killed in order to gain the notoriety necessary to get his manifesto out into the public eye, and it worked. When it was published, the Washington Post sold something like 1.2 million copies that day, which is still a record. And he devised a plan, executed it, and thereby caused millions of people to contemplate the problem of technology in a way they had never had before. Unfortunately, I missed that one. Because I think, you know, 1995, there was 20 years that it would have saved me of putting all of my time and effort, 80 hours a week, into helping build the machine and educate the future machine builders. You know, I really feel so absolutely duped by what has happened. Does the end justify the means? Well, it is too early to tell. If Kaczynski's actions ultimately have some effect on averting technological disaster, there will be no doubt his actions were justified. They may have saved millions of lives, not to mention much of the natural world, but only time will tell. Question, you recently wrote a book, The Metaphysics of Technology. Can you tell us a little about that? This is this Michigan professor, philosophy professor. Sure. I'm thinking about the problem of technology, and it struck me that there was very little philosophical analysis about what exactly technology is. We have had many action plans ranging from tepid and mild to Bill Joy's thesis of relinquishment of key technologies, which we're going to get back to Bill Joy's story out of Wired from 2000 called Why Technology Doesn't Need Us Anymore, to Kaczynski's total revolution. But if we don't really understand what we're dealing with, our actions are likely to be misguided and ineffectual. In short, we need true metaphysics of technology. So on my view, technology advances with a tremendous autonomous power. Humans are the implementers of this power, but can we really guide it? And are we certainly, wait, and can we, but we can't really guide it, and we certainly can't stop it. And in effect, it functions as a law of nature. It advances with evolutionary force, and we just read about evolutionary robotics the other day, where the mother robot, when she was creating the underling baby robots, each generation that then created the next generation created them so their good traits were dominant, and they got rid of the traits that didn't work well for them. Like literally each generation of robotics building the next had evolution that was taking place naturally. And that was very frightening. It says, it advances with an evolutionary force. So he's absolutely correct. And that's where, why we are heading toward disaster. I see technology much as the ancient Greeks did, as a combination of two potent entities, techne and logos, hence the name technology. For them, they were quasi-divine forces. Logos was the guiding intelligence behind all of the order in the universe, and techne was the process by which all things, man-made or otherwise, came into being. These were not mere mythology. They were rational conclusions regarding the operation of the cosmos. And he is right. Techne, meaning the process by which all things came into being, and logos, which is the intelligence behind them. Like the Greeks, I argue that techne is a universal process, and all order in the universe is a form of techne. Hence my coining of the term pan, which I couldn't say this, pantechnicon, the universe as an orderly construction manifesting a kind of intelligence or logos. Our modern human technology is on a continuum with all order in the universe. Harvard astrophysicist Eric Chasson has argued for precisely the same point, incidentally, in his 2006 book called Epic of Evolution. The net effect of all of this is not good news for us. Technology is like a wave moving through the Earth and the universe. And for a while, we were at the peak of that wave, and we absolutely were. But now we are on the downside of the technology wave. Technology is rapidly heading toward true autonomy, and our opportunity to slow or redirect is rapidly vanishing. If technology achieves true autonomy and we can take Kurzweil's singularity date of 2045 as a rough guide, then it is game over for us. We will likely either become more or less enslaved or else wiped out, and then technology will continue on its merry way without us. This is not mere speculation on my part, incidentally. Within the past year, we've had, and we've talked about these guys, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and even Bill Gates come out with related concerns, and they don't understand the metaphysics behind it, but they are seeing the same trend. Question, has your experience communicating with Kaczynski changed you as a person and as a philosopher? Well, as a philosopher, not that much. Kaczynski generally avoids philosophy and metaphysics, preferring practical issues. But in a sense, we are operating on different planes, even though we are working on the same problem. As a person, I have a greater understanding for the basis of extreme actions that he took. And it is not often in life that you get a chance to communicate with someone that has such a total commitment to their cause. It's very impressive. Also, the media treatment of his whole case has been enlightening. When his book, Technological Slavery, came out in 2010, which I'd never heard that he'd written a book either, I expected that there would at least be some media coverage on it, but there was none. The most famous quote-unquote American terrorist publishes a complete book from a supermax prison, and it's not news? Seriously? Compare this topic to the garbage shown in our national evening news programs, and it's a joke. NPR, 60 Minutes, Wired Magazine, etc. all decided that it wasn't newsworthy. Very telling. One last thing. Expect to hear from Kaczynski again soon. His second book is nearing completion. The provisional title is, quote, Anti-Tech Revolution, Why and How. But don't look for it on your evening news. So keep an eye out for that. I know I'm going to. Anti-Tech Revolution, Why and How by Kaczynski, coming soon. So I have to give kudos to Brian Whitney. I'm glad he sent me his story because that definitely was enlightening. Like I said, I don't know if he's ever listened to Before the First Cup or not, but I am glad that he thought of us. All right, so now let's take a little sidestep over to Kaczynski's manifesto. I just want to read the first couple paragraphs. I know we read a little bit of this before, but it goes along really well with the story that we just read. Introduction by Ted Kaczynski. The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased our life expectancy of those of us who live in advanced countries, but they have destabilized society and have made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, have led to widespread psychological suffering in the third world, to physical suffering as well, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. Can you say taser drones and nanobots in the soil, DARPA lady terraforming Earth and Mars? I mean, this when I start reading this stuff and realizing that these things were written so many years ago, I just honestly feel so beyond violated at how brainwashed we were to open our arms to embrace all this and help them further the agenda. And I mean, honestly, when I get back to that Bill Joy story next, he sees the same exact thing. I mean, his whole life was about technology. He watched Star Trek. He did all the same and similar things that I did growing up that made me believe in that world. And now, after all of his work and his creations that he's brought into this world. I mean, he's a pretty heavy duty technological dude that's done a lot of things in the world of Unix and invented Java and things of that, supercomputing back in the early days. You know, it's just so disturbing that the technology has been taken to the level of total and ultimate enslavement, to the potential of actually destroying the natural biology of everything that we as a species have known. All right, back to Kaczynski. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. It will probably lead to greater social disruption and psychological suffering, and it may lead to increased physical suffering even in advanced countries. The industrial technological system may survive or it may break down, but if it survives, it may eventually achieve a low level of physical and psychological suffering, but only after passing through a long and very painful period of adjustment, and only at the cost of permanently reducing human beings and other living organisms to engineered products and mere cogs in the social machine. And we see that happening already. Synthetic biology, upside down and sideways. It's game on for them to try to recreate not only human life, but everything in our environment so it can be bagged, tagged, and patented. Furthermore, if the system survives, the consequences will be inevitable. There is no way of reforming or modifying the system so as to prevent it from depriving people of dignity and autonomy. And honestly, I think our autonomy is pretty much gone already by this point. If the system breaks down, the consequences will still be very painful. But the bigger the system grows, the more disastrous the results of the breakdown will be. So if it is to break down, it had best break down sooner rather than later. Well, that's out a window. And I mean, they've already pointed out a bazillion times how devastating it'll be if we have an EMP the size of the Carrington event that happened back in the early 1900s when we were only using Morse code and telegraphs. Versus now, where the entire planet is connected via the digital age. We therefore advocate a revolution against the industrial system. This revolution may or may not use the use of violence. It may be sudden or it may be relatively gradual process spanning a few decades. We can't predict any of that, but we do outline in a very general way the measures that those who hate the industrial system should take in order to prepare the way for a revolution against that form of society. This is not to be a political revolution. Its object will be the overthrow of not governments, but the economic and the technological basis of the present society. And that is exactly it. It's, you know, we've been looking now at this economic instability that is happening right now, and how are they propping it up? Oh, by digitally printing more money. The banking system is the technology system. They are the ones with the puppet strings that are keeping the system running until they can move it to the next level. In this, and I mean, now it's all governments. Everybody is involved in the technological takeover. In this article, we give attention to not only some of the negative developments that have grown out of the industrial technological system, other such developments we mention only briefly or ignore altogether. This does not mean that we regard any of these other developments as unimportant. For example, for practical reasons, we have to confine our discussion to areas that have received insufficient public attention or which we have something new to say. So anyway, then it continues and it looks into the entire leftist movement and how they have utilized these leftist groups that seem to be running after a cause to kind of psychologically manipulate society. What I thought was very interesting, and I mean, it goes on and on and on, and it's kind of beyond the scope of what I want to talk about today. But what I thought was very interesting that Kaczynski mentions is that it ends up being a society where everybody is hypersensitive, where all of these lefty groups that are trying to save the world from all of their, you know, disparate, underprivileged organizations, let's say, it becomes where society is so overly sensitive that you can't use certain words and that everybody is pointing to each other as being bigots or being insensitive. And I mean, that's exactly what's happened. The universities have spawned this very radical leftist, for the good of all type thinking that then has led to what is happening right now. And I mean, it's causing lots of division, number one. But number two, it has now made it almost criminal. If you are on the more conservative side, let's say, let's just back the truck up, Chuck, and take a look at some of the stuff like vaccines. The lefties are the ones that are all fighting because Johnny ruins a bunch of people's Disney World vacations, and it's your kid, Johnny. You're the one who ruined it. The lefties are the ones that are all pro-vaccine. They're not the ones that are looking at what's going on in the world of vaccines. And we're going to, if we have time, I want to get to a story I found as well. We've been looking at all this newfangled vaccine technology and all the forced vaccines and the Vaccinate All Children Act of 2015 and the Healthy People 2020 Act. I mean, it's coming down the pipeline. We see this technology interwoven with governments and regulatory agencies. So it no longer is going to be a personal choice. Technology states, statistically speaking, per the CDC, I just saw some big CDC poster guaranteeing me that it was so wonderful for my kid to get the Gardasil vaccine, and there have been no adverse reactions. What a bold-faced lie that is. But we just believe it because they told us it was so. It's gotten rid of, the lefty movement has gotten rid of critical thinking. People like to follow others. They aren't leaders. They aren't thinkers. And we've been groomed to be followers. Don't be a follower. Question everything. All right. So that's a good segue to take us now into this article, Wired Magazine in the Archives, from April of 2000 by Bill Joy, founder of Sun Microsystems, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. We're going to start on page 3 because we did 1 and 2 back about a month ago. Anyway, all right, this is Bill Joy. Part of the answer certainly lies in our attitude toward the new, in our bias toward the instant familiarity and unquestioning acceptance, just like I said. We don't. Science knows better. Don't question science. And the technocracy is now in charge. So don't hurt your puny little brains. Just pay attention to your mobile devices, right? Pay attention to your reality TV. Pay attention to your video games and work hard, Johnny, because you're going to have a job working for us, getting rid of insurgents in the future. Your unquestioning acceptance. All right, back to his thing. Accustomed to living with almost routine scientific breakthroughs, we have yet to come to terms with the fact that the most compelling 21st century technologies, such as robotics, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology, pose a different threat than the technologies that have come before. Specifically, robots, engineered organisms, and nanobots share a dangerous amplifying factor. They can self-replicate. And how many times have we talked about that? And they've done it. It's happening already. A bomb is blown up only once, but a bot can become many and quickly get out of control. And when we started listening to the father of nanotechnology, and off the top of my head, I can't remember his name right now, out of MIT, and he talked about the nanofactories. And I mean, they're already playing with nanofactories at some of the higher educational institutions such as MIT. Back to the story. Much of my work over the past 25 years has been on computer networking, where sending and receiving of messages creates the opportunity for out-of-control replication. But while replication in a computer or on a computer network can be a nuisance, at worst it disables a machine or takes down a network or a network service. Uncontrolled self-replication in these newer technologies runs a much greater risk, a risk of substantial damage to the physical world. Each of these technologies also offers untold promise. The vision of near immortality that Kurzweil sees in his robot dreams drives us forward. Genetic engineering may soon provide treatments, if not outright cures, for most diseases. And nanotechnology and nanomedicine can address yet more ills. And remember, this story was written in 2000. The stuff is happening today, exactly right now, today. Together, they could significantly extend our average lifespans and improve the quality of our lives. Yet, with each of these technologies, a sequence of small, individually sensible advances leads to an accumulation of great power and great danger. What was different in the 20th century? Certainly, the technologies underlying the weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, and chemical, were powerful, and the weapons an enormous threat. But building nuclear weapons required, at least for a time, access to both rare and indeed effectively unavailable raw materials and highly protected information. Biological and chemical weapons programs also tended to require large-scale activities. In the 21st century technologies, however, genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics are so powerful that they can spawn whole new classes of accidents and abuses. Most dangerously, for the first time, these accidents and abuses are widely within the reach of individuals or small groups and will not require large facilities or rare raw materials. Knowledge alone will enable the use of them. Thus, we have the possibility of not just of weapons of mass destruction, but of knowledge-enabled mass destruction, this destructiveness hugely amplified by the power of self-replication. And he is 100% correct. And how interesting that he mentions nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs and how we've tied the entire biological weapons program into everything that is happening right now with all of these new biotech companies with this RNAi technology and the genomics and the Brain Project. They're all tied back to the Department of Defense and DARPA sprinkle money. It's all the same thing. They've just taken destruction to the next level. All right, back to the story. I think it is no exaggeration to say that we are on the cusp of the further perfection of extreme evil, an evil whose possibility spreads well beyond that which weapons of mass destruction bequeath to the nation states onto a surprising and terrible empowerment of extreme individuals. Nothing about the way I got involved with computers suggested to me that I was going to be facing these kinds of issues. And I am going to second that opinion. In the last 25 years of my career, I had never in my life thought that some of this science fiction that I love to hate in dystopia would be the actual truths of the future that I was facing. Never in my wildest dreams. All right, back to the story. I have not been disappointed. My work has had more impact than I had ever hoped for and has been more widely used than I could ever reasonably have expected. I've spent the last 20 years still trying to figure out how to make computers as reliable as I want them to be and how to make them simple to use, which is a goal that is met with even less relative success. Back in 2000, we were just getting there. Now it's dumb end user friendly. But despite some progress, the problems that remain seem even more daunting. But while I was aware of the moral dilemma surrounding technology's consequences in fields like weapons research, I did not expect that I would confront such issues in my own field, or at least not so soon. Me too. Perhaps it is always hard to see the bigger impact while you are in the vortex of a change. Failing to understand the consequences of our inventions while we are in the rapture of discovery. And that's exactly it. I mean, it's a total rush to be on the leading edge of a wave of something new. And you are one of the people that are in the know. I lived that life. The mid-90s, man, there was nothing ever like it. I don't think we will. I mean, right now for biotech, I'm sure those people are feeling the same way. I don't think they see how this is going to end up for humanity. Failing to understand the consequences of our inventions while we are in the rapture of discovery and innovation seems to be a common fault of scientists and technologists. We have long been driven by the overarching desire to know That is the nature of science quests and not stopping to notice that the progress to newer and more powerful technologies can take on a life of its own. I have long realized that the big advances in information technology come not from the work of computer scientists, computer architects, or electrical engineers, but from that of physical scientists. The physicists Stephen Wolfram and Brasil Hochler introduced me in the early 1980s to chaos theory and nonlinear systems. In the 1990s, I learned about complex systems from conversations with Danny Hills, the biologist Stuart Kaufman, the Nobel laureate physicist Murray Gell-Mann, and others. And most recently, Hochler and the electrical engineer and device physicist Mark Reed have been giving me insight into the incredible possibilities of molecular electronics. And yeah, and that again was 15 years ago. We're there already. But because of the recent rapid advances and radical progress in molecular electronics, where individual atoms and molecules replace lithographically drawn transistors and related nanoscale technologies, we should be able to meet or exceed Moore's law at the rate of progress for another 30 years or so. For decades, Moore's law has correctly predicted exponential rate of improvement of semiconductor technology. And until last year, I believed that the rate of advances predicted by Moore's law might continue only until roughly 2010, when some physical limits would begin to be reached. But with all the related nanoscale technologies, we should be able to meet or exceed Moore's law for at least another 30 years, and by 2030, we are likely to be able to build machines in quantity at a million times more powerful than personal computers of today, sufficient to implement the dreams of Kurzweil and Moravec. Now, that should send chills down your spine. Because Kurzweil, though he sounds like a complete lunatic, remember, he is the head of engineering for Google and has a pretty much unlimited budget, is in bed with governments and defense departments, and Google knows everything about you. Back to the story. As this enormous computing power is combined with the manipulative advances of physical sciences and the new deep understandings in genetics, enormous transformative power is being unleashed. These combinations open up the opportunity to completely redesign the world for better or for worse. The replicating and evolving processes that have been confined to the natural world are about to become realms of human endeavor. And we are here. They've opened the box. In designing software and microprocessors, I have never had the feeling that I was designing an intelligent machine. The software and hardware are so fragile, and the capabilities of the machine to quote-unquote think so clearly absent. Even as a possibility, this has always seemed very far into the future. But now, with the prospect of human-level computing power in about 30 years, and we're already 15 years into it, a new idea suggests itself that I may be working to create tools which will enable the construction of technology that may replace our species. How do I feel about this? And guys, what got me so much about this Bill Joy essay is that that is the exact realization that I had one day, 4 or 5 years ago, when I really started to understand what was happening. We are helping to construct the destruction of biology. So he asks, how do I feel about this? Well, very uncomfortable. Having struggled my entire career to build reliable software systems, it seems to me more than likely that this feature will not work out as well as some people may have imagined. My personal experience suggests that we tend to overestimate our design abilities, and given the incredible power of these new technologies, shouldn't we be asking how we can best coexist with them and if our own extinction is a likely or even possible outcome of our technological development, then shouldn't we proceed with great caution? And that's the problem. Where is the caution? Where's the ethics? Where are the millions of people that are standing up saying, stop for a second, stop forcing your quote unquote technological innovation on me because it's good for me, because it's good for the planet, because you decided that this is the way that we need to evolve as a species? Where is our choice in the matter? Because there isn't a choice. You know, when you go to the doctor and you're with your kid and you're getting grilled for 2 hours, like you're at an inquisition as to how you're raising that child and what your child is eating and whether or not, you know, you understand these new vaccines and how wonderful they are. And, oh, you're going to hear more about it on a commercial on TV. And, oh, my goodness, how horrible it was. We saw a case of that meningitis in our office, and we don't want to get that here. They're taking all of these newfangled, I'm telling you, the vaccines are at, and maybe we'll get to this vaccine story, 271 new vaccines sitting in the pipeline that need to be tested. Remember, we've talked about Project BioShield. We've talked about all these biopharma institutions being tied to universities and being tied to the DOD, DARPA, the places like Monsanto buying the same technology that they're using in vaccinations for pesticides. Being able, they literally are at a point where they can turn genetic switches on and off. Right then and there. Why would anything like that be allowed into your child without a question? And why should you be grilled and demonized and potentially even reported now for being a danger to your child for not just readily accepting technology without question? And anyone who does question it is deemed to be a tinfoil hat wearing lunatic, even though we've discovered FDA studies time and time again that were printed and later be found fraudulent. Oh, what did we just find? The representative out of Florida that went up in front of the House and presented whistleblower CDC papers showing that they had destroyed evidence that supported that the MMR vaccine caused autism. How are we? But you know what? All of that is brushed aside and under the table and not in the mainstream, so nobody believes it. So when you bring up things like that, you are just seen as a troublemaker. You are seen as someone unstable. You are seen as a problem to the system. You must embrace technology. All right, I think we should finish with the rest of this. Okay, the dream of robotics is, first, that intelligent machines can do our work for us, allowing us to live lives of leisure, which that's how they're touting it right now, restoring us back to Eden. Yet, in his history of such ideas, Darwin, among the machines, George Tyson warns that in the game of life and evolution, there are three players at the table: human beings, nature, and machines. I am firmly on the side of nature, but nature, I suspect, is on the side of machines. As we have seen, and Moravec agrees, believing we may well not survive the encounter with a superior robot species. A second dream of robotics is that we will gradually replace ourselves with robotic technology, achieving near or immortality by downloading our consciousness. It is this process that Danny Hill thinks we will gradually get used to, and that Ray Kurzweil elegantly details in The Age of Spiritual Machines. But if we are downloaded into our technology, what are the chances that we will thereafter be ourselves or even be human? It seems to me far more likely that a robotic existence would not be like a human in any sense that we understand, and that robots would in no sense be our children, that on this path our humanity may well be lost. And I would second that. Genetic engineering promises to revolutionize agriculture by increasing crop yields while reducing the use of pesticides to create tens of thousands of novel species of bacteria, plants, viruses, and animals to replace reproduction or supplement it with cloning to create cures for many diseases, increasing our lifespan and our quality of life, and much, much more. We now know with certainty that these profound changes in the biological sciences are imminent and will challenge our notions of what life is. And people, we're there already. They're doing that. Technologies such as human cloning have in particular raised our awareness of the profound ethical and moral issues we face. And if, for example, we were to re-engineer ourselves into several separate and unequal species using the power of genetic engineering, and we've talked about that, then we would threaten the notion of equality that is the very cornerstone of our democracy that doesn't exist. And given the incredible power of genetic engineering, it is no surprise that there are significant safety issues in its use. Just take a look at the CRISPR gene drive. They can wipe out an entire species. My friend Armory Lovins recently co-wrote, along with Hunter Lovins, an editorial that provides an ecological view of these dangers. And among their concerns is that, quote, the new botany aligns the development of plants with their economic, not evolutionary success. And we see that. I mean, it is not about saving the planet. It is about the control of all life on Earth. And that is where it comes down to. All of our crops, all of our cells, they'll be able to bag, tag, and track everything. Well, guys, I don't know. I think that's where we're going to end it up for today. I wanted to look at some minds of the past and how they viewed things. And I got to tell you, they are just right on track. We're where we are seeing now, 15, 20 years in the future, fast forward, and we are exactly where they said we were going to be. We need to become lightites, people. We need to rage against the machine. All right, make sure you stick around because it is Friday, and up next is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission, Josh with the Anti-Tyranny News live at 6, Primer Time with Michael and Nick at 8, 9, Truth on the Tracks with Brandon Turville, Reality Bites at 10, and Inside Media with 5.